Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to a July 25th segment from the Kentucky Water Fuel Museum. Tonight's guest is Phil Ratté. And Mr. Ratté, are you with us?
Yes, sir.
Very good. I'm sorry I wasn't able to confirm that earlier. Welcome to the program. And Mr. Ratté has a very impressive resume having to do with mechanical engineering, and in particular, an interest in high miles per gallon engines, vehicles, and the use of alternative fuels, in particular ethanol, to help America and the world be free of dependence on fossil fuels. We have about an hour ahead of us, Mr. Ratté. I'd be very interested in hearing how it is that you got interested in these matters of alternative energy and alternative fuels. Could we start with how you first became interested in such a thing as a high mile per gallon vehicle?
Well, back in the late 1970s, when we had the little energy crunch, I just decided I'd start to test. Various people were advertising devices and additives and magnets and such to improve fuel consumption, and I decided to start testing them. And since then, since about 1979 till present, I've tested over 100 different devices and additives and magnets and such. And in fact, I was hired as an expert witness in a criminal trial in Missouri where a fuel-saving magnet distributor was indicted for felony fraud by the Attorney General of the state of Missouri. And I went up against two PhDs and the head of an EPA lab, and they came out second.
Really?
And
why were they accusing the device of being fraudulent if it in fact wasn't?
Well, what they did is they did a 20-minute test on a dyno, and right on the label of the product it said that oftentimes takes 3 to 4 tankfuls to get optimal performance. So they got no results in 20 minutes and said the thing didn't work. And besides, their technical information said that there's no way that magnet could have any effect on a fuel or water or whatever, and we now know that that's bogus.
So I
proved it back then.
What is the effect that such a magnet has on fuel?
Well, there are a number of theories. It's my contention that what a magnet does is weaken the hydrogen bond and the long-chain hydrocarbon molecules so that under turbulent flow, the molecules will break up into smaller segments that are more volatile, like going from tar to naphtha or something, and that's basically what happens. That's basically what a lot of the devices and additives and stuff do, is try to break the longer chain molecules into shorter chain.
I see. Very interesting. So what was the first energy-saving device of these 100 and some?
Do not remember. It's a long time ago.
But in
other
words,
28 years ago.
The oil crisis... The oil embargo that happened in 1973 is what got you and many other people actually.
Well, I was the second, this the second go round when there were lines out east and all that, in the late 70s.
Oh, I see. Okay.
When they went from leaded to unleaded gas, that was basically the reason for that crisis back then. Just like the problem we had, this rather small problem we had this spring was caused by the fact that diesel went from low sulfur to ultra-low sulfur from 500 parts per million down to, I think it was, 15 parts per million or so. And so it was difficult to get the refineries to convert over to do that. It was more difficult than they thought, and in some cases, and that caused a disruption in the even gasoline stocks.
Very interesting. Now, there are several people that you have come in contact with or have learned about that I think our listeners would benefit from your observations, your comments about such individuals. I understand that you have certain knowledge about Charles Pogue.
Pogue was up in a nursing home up in Canada, I believe, near Winnipeg. And a friend of mine, back in the 80s, was teaching people how to build 100-mile-per-gallon carburetors. Well, of course, now that doesn't work so well since we've got fuel injection and computers in the cars. But back then, he was quite successful doing that. I was going around the country teaching people how to convert carburetors.
And who was this individual?
His name was, it's escaping me at the moment. It'll come to me while I'm talking here.
Is he the one who produced a booklet, a small booklet about this?
Probably a couple.
And he would sell them for like $20 through the back of magazines and whatnot?
I believe so. He lives about, I don't know, 3 or 4 miles from me, just north of me. And I'm having a mental block on his name.
Well, I think I have a copy of one of those brochures that he would sell.
I talked to people who were running at in excess of 100 miles per gallon. It was not difficult to do, but since then they've changed the additives and probably changed the fuel some and make it more difficult to vaporize. But at any rate, back in he was teaching people how to do that, and he went up once a month for a while to meet with Pogue, because you know that's what Pogue was, kind of the originator of that concept. Or at least one of the originators, and
about a 1934 patent on this type of fuel vaporizer, huh?
Correct. Yeah, they actually changed the way gasoline was made so they could defeat his carburetor. When they went to catalytic cracking, they got more heavy ends in the gasoline, and those heavy ends, the spontaneous ignition point of the heavy end, I'm sorry, the total vaporization point of the heavy ends was above the spontaneous ignition point of the light end, so you have a bomb. If you try to completely vaporize the fuel using heat, you have a bomb because you explode the light ends and the whole thing goes up.
You mean now?
Yeah, now. Well, ever since catalytic cracking, which is late 1930s.
So in other words, previously it was possible for a person to do cracking under their hood to safely do it, as Pogue was doing. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it still is now if you get yourself white gas or the gas that's similar to the wellhead gas that they had back then. And that, what wellhead gas means, it was refined at the wellhead, and they didn't do any catalytic cracking or such.
So in other words, Pogue taught them to do catalytic cracking, is that it?
Oh, he didn't teach them, he motivated them to do it.
Yeah.
I think they knew about it, but it was probably a considerable expenditure to do that, but they had to do that, otherwise he would have beat their brains out.
Yeah, and so
just like he did to Rommel in World War II.
Maybe you could talk about that briefly.
Yeah,
In other words,
I'm forgetting this fellow's name, but at any rate, he called me one time and said he'd been up to see Pogue and that he had kind of an amazing story. He said Pogue told him that he had worked for one of the car companies that was building tanks in Detroit during the war, before and during the war, and he provided his carburation system for our tanks that had gas engines. And the Battle of El Alamein was the turning point of World War II. Rommel had been running roughshod across the British, through the British, across the desert, hoping to take control of the Sinai and Egypt and everything. And El Alamein happened. What Rommel had been doing was chasing the British tanks until they ran out of gas, because his tanks had a longer range and he'd run them out of their, they'd lose track of their fuel supplies, and then he'd run them down and they ran out of gas, and then his tanks would back off and they'd let the artillery pick them off, so that they didn't get into a slugfest with the British tanks. And so we did the same thing to Rommel, and that's how he was defeated, because our tanks using the Pogue carburation were much more efficient than the excellent diesel engines that the German tanks had.
Now, has there ever been any documentation of this?
Yeah, I've seen this since, and I unfortunately have not. I may have saved it, but I haven't looked to see if I saved it.
For instance, somebody once commented that Rommel actually made mention of this after the war.
I'm sure he did. No, after the war, he died during the war. He killed himself.
See, I looked at his memoirs, which were published in English, I guess, more recently. I found a copy in our local library, and I looked it over, and there was no mention of such a thing in there.
It might have been, you see, he had people with him who undoubtedly wrote about this after the war. You know, like Patton had people, he died during the war too, but people published material after the war about Patton, and I'm sure they did about Rommel also.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see something in print.
They have those what he said, and I understand they had a black box that surrounded the carburation, and they were forbidden to touch that. In fact, if a tank was taken down, there would be a crew go out there if they could get to the tank and get the carburation system out of it, so the Germans couldn't get a hold of it.
Isn't that interesting? So, in other words, Pogue was told in 1934, apparently he was bought out or otherwise...
Oh, no, he wasn't. He had his patent. It's just that the patent didn't work anymore. His vaporizing carburetor would clog up with all kinds of gunk, you know, tar and creosote and such, the heavy ends that weren't that they couldn't vaporize out.
I see. So the reformulation of gasoline kept his invention from working anyway.
Right. In other words, currently, you know, the difference between diesel fuel and gasoline has to do with the amount of heavy ends that are in diesel fuel.
Okay. So apparently, though, this person who visited Pogue in the nursing home years after, this would be in the 80s, you're saying?
This was in the 80s.
Pogue would then have been a very old man.
Ah, yes, right.
And what story did he have to tell about his invention and what became of it?
Oh, I don't remember. The one I remember is the one about Rommel because it was so striking, and I had not none of that had occurred to me. I know where he is. Having a loss for his name, but you could probably have him on one of your calls, and he could talk much more indulgently about this because he actually talked to Pogue.
Yeah.
And he made copious. He's a prolific note taker. So.
But I understand that Pogue's device was tested by Ford Motor Company.
Absolutely, between 100 and 200 miles a gallon in Ford trucks up in Canada.
And they documented that. That is something that is available in writing.
I don't know. I have not seen documentation, but it's been written about quite a bit.
Yeah, I've seen a copy of it.
Oh, you have?
I
have not.
There's a copy of it available online.
See, I wasn't a great fan of vaporization. I was more into ethanol and then eventually into water.
Now, it seems that in one of these references here, it says that you and another inventor by the name of Hansen,
yes,
were involved in mixing water with ethanol.
Right. His name was Herb Hansen, and I drove in a vehicle that he had converted with his... He actually had a patent. He didn't have a patent when I first rode in it, but a couple years later he got his patent. And what he did is he preheated the fuel. And my contribution was to also preheat the air so that we could use even lower amounts of ethanol. In the beginning, when I met him, he was using 165 proof ethanol because that's what Henry Ford ran his cars and trucks and such on in the 1920s and early 1930s. And when we used the exhaust heat to preheat the air as well as using the radiator heat to preheat the ethanol, we were able to use much lower proof ethanol. In fact, we were using two-thirds water and one-third ethanol when Herb had a very convenient stroke stroke at a very convenient time for the oil cartel. I don't know if they ever made an offer to him. He didn't ever tell me that. But he was a wealthy guy, so he wouldn't have paid any attention to it.
What was his age at the time of that stroke?
Late 60s.
Yeah, okay.
But he had had a major stroke and a major heart attack before I met him. This was 8 years later, and he was in fine shape by then. I'm a kind of a devotee of health remedies and nutrition and such, and I helped him get on a good program. And he was fully good health according to his doctor.
So you feel that his death was somewhat suspicious?
Yeah, I didn't. Well, when it happened, I didn't. I was supposed to go down there on a Saturday, and on Wednesday the lawyer called me and said that we had a 2-year temporary license on the patent, and he was supposed to change it over for the life of the patent. And the reason we did that 2-year temporary is because we were building the prototypes, and we didn't, there's no way to profit from it or even be in final production until we get prototypes done. And we did have the two prototypes, and they ran as well on 65 proof ethanol or 2/3 water as the vehicles did beforehand. One was a Mitsubishi sedan out in California. The fellow that developed that one was a retired captain of a nuclear submarine, so he was a very capable engineer. And Herb himself was a boiler engineer. As a young man, he was a boiler engineer on submarines, and his submarines sunk 14 Jap ships in World War II. So he was a very interesting guy. In fact, I've got a tape that is just terrific to listen to. He talks about the Mark V torpedo, which ran on a spray of alcohol, spray of water, and compressed air in a combustion chamber the size of a basketball. Had developed 350 brake horsepower, and that turbine ran a torpedo at 50 miles an hour underneath the surface of the water, and the torpedoes weighed 3,200 pounds.
Wow. Boy, that sounds like a turbine that we could use, huh?
Sure. You aren't going to see it, though.
Yeah, that's very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. But there's another thing, too. You know, the Japanese Zero ran on ethanol.
Really?
I don't know what proof. I do not know that, but I do know they ran on ethanol. That's why they could outclimb our best planes in the early part of the war by 2,000 feet, because ethanol has some oxygen in it, so they were able to go higher and come out of the sun. That's why they used to talk about the Zeros coming out of the sun, because they could climb higher and they'd try to get the sun behind them.
Very interesting. So ethanol technology really goes back to the early part of the 20th century.
Well, people have been making booze for a long time. You know, alcohol is developed a long time ago, thousands of years ago.
So what's good for your liver is good for the engine, huh?
Yeah, and the alcohol is not particularly good for the liver. It is regarded by the body as a poison, but it's certainly better for it than anything that comes from crude oil.
Yeah.
Including prescription drugs and agricultural chemicals and any of the automobile products. Are you aware right now, well, in Minnesota, I don't know about elsewhere in the country, but in Minnesota, on many of our fuel pumps, there's a little health warning on there that tells you not to drink it and not to put on your skin and such. And it kind of in the middle of it, it says, and experimental animals exposed to fuel vapors have contracted cancer. I think that's probably one of the reasons for all this hoorah about global warming, because they don't want people to realize that what's coming out of their tailpipe is causing cancer down the road, you know.
Yeah.
And in fact, they must have lost a big lawsuit or something to be forced to put that up on the pumps.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, I found a research paper on the internet several months ago that talked about the suppression of ethanol use back in the 30s.
Right.
And that the oil companies were responsible for some FBI investigations of politicians who were promoting ethanol use.
Well, it's a member of this, the 16th Amendment. No, not 16th Amendment. The amendment for a prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
That was back in the 20s. And that was specifically intended to stop the use of ethanol in Ford cars and trucks. See, Ford Model T and Model A, for sure, I think A probably stood for alcohol. But in the Model A, there's a Herb had two Model A's, and there's a little lever on the carburetor, and you flip it one way to the G, and it's gasoline. The other way, it's A for alcohol.
Is that right?
And it changed the amount of air fuel ratio.
So, backing up just a little bit, are you saying that the prohibition in the United States had more to do with fuel than it did with drunkenness?
Absolutely. There was a big fight between Rockefeller, who was promoting fuel, and Henry Ford, who was promoting ethanol because it would save the farm. I can tell you there's a lot of farms being saved in Minnesota now with the ethanol.
So this is something that the public is totally unaware of.
Yeah, well, it's something that it kind of is a figment of my imagination, okay? But when you think about it, there were more people drinking during Prohibition and after Prohibition than beforehand, so it didn't do a very good job of that. But Eliot Ness and his little buddies would go out in the back hills of Kentucky and Tennessee and break up these stills, you know, where supposedly these people were transporting the booze in the town, which may indeed, and which was probably going on, but what they're more concerned about is that those cars and trucks out there in those farms were being run on ethanol from sugar or corn or something and not being run on Rockefeller's poison.
Huh. Very
See, gasoline was a waste byproduct of the oil industry. And they used to, out in Oklahoma, for instance, they had used to have acres and acres of gasoline evaporating into the air under the summer sun because it was a waste byproduct. And here where they found something they could do with it so they could make money and poison the planet at the same time.
Interesting. Well, it's obvious that there has been a definite push to market anything that results from the distillation of petroleum.
Precisely. Well, you know, the biggest money makers from petroleum are the prescription drugs. Prescription drugs make a terrific product. In other words, most drugs that cost like $100 a month cost about 24 cents for the ingredients, which are basically petrochemicals.
Interesting.
That have been somehow converted into a molecule similar to some natural molecule, but the body regards as poison.
Yeah. So it's not the best remedy for health.
In trauma situation, these drugs have a place, but in dealing with degenerative diseases like heart trouble and cancer and all the rest of them, it's an absolute abomination. There's no place. There's no need for it. There's no place for it. In fact, they're counterproductive, but they make a lot of money for drug companies, and doctors have all been purchased by the drug companies.
Yeah. And then what about the petrochemical fertilizers and pesticides? I mean, couldn't the same be said about them?
Absolutely. I'm after three enemies: the agricultural chemical companies, the oil companies, and the prescription drug companies. And I've found kind of unique solutions for each one of them, and I've been trying to promote them and talk about them politically, but it takes a while before you get traction. Now there's traction under fuel-saving ideas and devices, and water as fuel. We'll see in the next few years that we'll be running vehicles on water.
Okay, let's talk about that now. We've talked about Pogue and Hansen. I think more could be said about Hansen. Perhaps we can get back to him in a minute. But since we're getting to the subject of water.
Well, you see, we were running on two-thirds water, Herb and I.
Yeah. Now, were you mixing it before injecting it, or were you?
Yeah. No, we had it. It was mixed. In fact, there's a funny story about that. Herb, before he met me, he was driving down south somewhere, and he was going through Georgia. And what he would do is pour in some alcohol and then pour some water in. So he stopped at this restaurant to get some lunch, and he poured 5 gallons of ethanol in there. Okay. And he needed to get some water, so he took in a couple gallon jugs into the restaurant with him, and he ordered his lunch, and when he paid his check, he asked the girl to get him some water. So she went over the sink and filled up these two jugs with water, and he went out to his car and poured the water into his gas tank. Now, the people didn't see him come and put the ethanol in before, nor did they, if they did, they wouldn't know what it was, right? So they knew what this was because she got it out of the tap, right? And so he pours his two gallons of water in there, and gets in the car and drives away, and he looked back and he saw all these people standing at the windows of the restaurant with their mouths wide open, you know.
Isn't that funny?
So, and the truth is, Henry Ford did run vehicles for years on ethanol, 165 proof, which is about like E85.
Yeah, I understand that was his original fuel of choice.
I have a comment for you about the E85. It's not maybe generally available around the country like it is in Minnesota. We've got more E85 stations, or at least we did last year, than the whole rest of the country put together. I have a fellow who has been promoting E85 more, using E85 in regular engines that are not flexi-fuel. And he has a lot of people doing it, maybe putting in 50% E85. The reason to do that is here in Minnesota, E85 is 40 to 50 cents a gallon cheaper.
Yeah, now for those unacquainted with E85, perhaps you could define what E85
is. Yeah, E85 means 85% ethanol and 15% unleaded regular.
Okay, and no other chemical additions, strictly gasoline?
I don't know that, but it's supposed to be strictly gasoline and ethanol, and it can vary anywhere from 72 to like 87% or something. It's not a strict 85%.
Now, what's the purpose of adding that small amount of gasoline to the ethanol?
Flexi-fuel is a vehicle that will run on anything from E85 all the way down to unleaded, all right, and any percentage in between. And if you get too much ethanol in there, you got to convert the engine too much so that it doesn't run well on gasoline. And so what you want to do is try to have a compromise so that you can run on anything from E85 to gasoline. So now an interesting thing about this is I met with a fellow for 4 hours. I promoted this at the state legislature, and he had quite a bit of background material. In fact, Minnesota passed a law earlier this year that by 2012, Minnesota will be 20% ethanol in our gasoline. as well as a lot of E85.
Yeah, in all the gasoline.
Yeah, in all the gasoline. Yeah. See, I promoted in 1978. I ran for the U.S. Senate and talked about four alternative energy ideas all the way through the Democratic convention, because the Democrats are much more receptive to fuel saving than Republicans, who normally are deeply in debt to the oil companies, you know. And anyway, but in 1986, I ran for governor, and all I talked about was ethanol blended fuels because of the terrific benefit to the economy of Minnesota if we would convert corn into ethanol. Because the truth is, if you convert corn into ethanol in the state of Minnesota, instead of sending the corn to Illinois to be processed into various food products, it doubles the income to the state of Minnesota, which is a big benefit for farmers and farm communities and the whole state in general.
So that's what they refer to as a value-added
product. Precisely. Sure.
Product.
See, most of the corn from Minnesota would be processed in big plants in Illinois or elsewhere, and now it's being processed here into ethanol and various other products that come out of the mash that's left over.
Yeah. Well, the governor of Kentucky is presently promoting the conversion of coal into a liquid fuel.
Like the Germans did in World War II. It's called the Fischer-Tropsch formula.
Is it the same technology?
Yeah, similar. It's based on, yes, obviously modernized with different catalysts and such. Now, here in Minnesota, a friend of mine down in southwestern Minnesota has been trying to get an ethanol plant built that will make ethanol out of corn stalks. It's called Corn Stover. See, corn goes up and down in price, and right now the price of corn is pretty high, and the price of Corn Stover is no different than it was a year or two or five or 10 years ago. And with this, using the Fischer-Tropsch process, which has been developed by a fellow down in Mississippi who has a 3-million-gallon-a-year ethanol plant, which is not a big ethanol plant. It's just intended to be testing for turning wood chips and turning various grasses and corn stalks, et cetera, into ethanol. And at any rate, this process, we did testing for 24 hours down in that plant, and we got it appears that we can use 30% less energy to turn the stover into ethanol than the corn itself.
Very interesting.
And if you take one of those plants, one of our plants, put alongside of a regular ethanol plant, the waste products from each plant goes over and helps drive the other plant. The only thing that is left over, the only thing that goes to out of that plant is the minerals that were in the corn in the first place, and those minerals are then put back on the land.
How do you like that?
It's a terrific concept, and it'll happen. Here in Minnesota, we got a coal gasification project, which is similar to what you're talking about, turning coal into coal gas in this case, but you can also turn it into methanol, and I expect you can turn it to ethanol too.
So these are ideas that you include in a 6-year proposal for getting off of fossil fuel, or foreign.
Right. What I did is I put 10 different ideas together that people can understand. In other words, there are a lot of very complicated things that are going on that are difficult to explain, difficult for people to understand. But these are things that people can understand, and I do have some credentials to talk about these things, you know. So they pay attention, because most people just don't have any concept of any of this.
Well,
I mean,
isn't
the people,
really a problem that
pardon me?
The average American now is not scientifically interested enough to want to grasp these things or be able to grasp them?
They don't have to. When you go over to the wall and flip on the light switch, do you have to know how it works to turn it on and make it work?
Well, and then the question, should you know?
Hmm? Yeah. But I'm just talking about being able to use it. But now the other thing is being able to get it to happen, because there's all these competing interests for research dollars and the problems of trying to overcome resistance by the oil companies and such, and all while it goes on political. But I'm here to tell you right now that there is a time and a place for everything. Timing and marketing and in politics is very important. The energy independence is a very hot subject, and what I try to do is help anybody who's doing something good here. I try to help them. I'm involved, in fact, with an additive right now, because it does get, my testing showed a 20% increase in a clean engine, so I promote it. And I know of some other things to do similar, and I try to help those people, you know. And I don't charge much for my testing, and I'm trying to see that this happens. And it may, eventually it is going to happen. I don't know if if the country will survive until then, but hopefully it will.
We're at the midway point of our program. Perhaps you can mention the web address where someone could find that product that you are promoting.
Well, I sent you a whole list of the of some of the websites I have about it. You could just share that with people, or people could just email me. I'll send them a whole bunch of stuff.
What is the product called?
It's called ME Square, Ultimate ME Square.
M-E and then the number 2?
ME Square, you know, like H2O.
Yeah, so but if someone was doing a word search, a Google search or something, they could type in ME2 and probably...
Just ME2. And my little web TV, I can put a square on my keyboard, but... You can just use ME2,
mm-hmm.
And it's I'm a distributor for them, but I don't. Whenever I do something like this, I don't aggressively promote that people should be involved with me. I just say, you know, find somebody in your local area or call the company, or you know. And some people want to be involved with me. That's fine, but that's not my purpose. My purpose is to see the product be successful.
Yeah, and you're really interested in seeing any product that works be successful, and that's why you've attested to over 100 different.
True. But now I've only given my professional opinion on those that would be economically feasible, which is in the neighborhood of 7 or 8.
Okay, perhaps we could talk about some of those. But first, let's get to the subject of water fuel, because that's the major focus of this program. And you have had personal experience with some water fuel device inventors, such as Stanley Meyer.
Right.
Was he the first person you had ever heard of who was involved in turning?
No. But Herb Hansen, we ran on 2/3 water.
Okay, so
we are undoubtedly getting some conversion to hydrogen, and because 1/3 of a gallon of ethanol is going to drive a car, like a gallon of gasoline, which has probably got about 6 times as much energy.
But you were not doing anything to break the water down into hydrogen and oxygen component gases.
No, but when you get over 1500 degrees, that does happen.
Okay, so you're saying that you were heating the fuel, the water ethanol mixture, using radiator water, right?
Right. We get that up to about 200 degrees.
Okay. And then you were also heating the intake air with
the truck? Heating the intake air, and so that was pretty hot, and so we had a lot more. We were much more. Thermal efficiency of a automobile engine is about 20 or 21%. And so 80% of the fuel that you buy is going out the tailpipe or out the radiator or the bearings or wherever in heat. And if you can reuse most of that heat like we did, you really increase thermal efficiency, and that certainly makes your engine therefore much more fuel efficient.
Now, were you using a carbureted or fuel-injected car for these tests?
We had a Ford. The one I worked with, Herb and I worked with, is in Elgin, Illinois. It was a Ford Pinto, old Ford Pinto station wagon, and we used the carburetor. What I counseled Herb on is not to change anything relative to the engine, but just we'll add on to it. So we added on, you know, heat exchangers and stuff to be able to heat the fuel.
Okay,
in
so
the
Pinto engine was a British-made four-cylinder, what was it, a 1600cc engine?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, and...
I'll tell you one thing, because it turned out to be a steam engine, you could put that car up against a tree and put it in gear, and it would burn the tires right down to the hubs. It would not stall.
Huh.
Like the old steam engines. And
really?
So we really had a steam engine. It had a great deal of low-end torque.
Now, did you ever disassemble an engine after having used it to see what the effect of the fuel on the inner...
Clean as can be.
Oh, you actually did do that?
Certainly.
You pulled the head and...
We worked on this for 8 years.
Okay. So there were no detrimental effects of using them?
Well, sure. There can be detrimental effects from ethanol to tubing and seals and such, and there were back in those days. But we had very little of that trouble. I think it's because we were using low-proof ethanol. Mm-hmm. Herb might have had some in the beginning, but I never experienced any.
And then what about the fuel mileage you were experiencing out of that Pinto?
About 10% less, but we never focused on mileage. We were trying to do... See, when I met Herb, when I first rode in his Pinto, it got he had mounted on the hood a fuel dispenser so you could measure the fuel as you drove down the road. You know, you could see how much we're using, how many miles, and whatever. And so we're getting 72 miles a gallon on 165 proof ethanol. And so that just kind of blew my mind. What I didn't realize is the engine.
What, 30 miles per gallon normally?
Oh, no, in the 20s.
Okay. And it's getting so three times the normal mileage using.
Right. But what I didn't realize is that the engine, well, and I didn't pay attention to the. I was doing a video. Okay. I had broadcast quality video equipment with me. I wanted to make 6 5-minute segments for a half hour TV show, and we have one extra segment. And this was going to be the sixth segment. And so I was taping, and I wasn't paying enough attention to what was going on. And the car was actually running when we got into it, and he drove so he didn't ever have to stop, and then got back and then just turned the car off. What I didn't realize is if you stopped like at a stop sign or something, the car would very likely die and be very difficult to restart. So we had to overcome problems like that so that it was as drivable as a regular car, so you wouldn't notice any difference. And that's the way our prototype was. And we got about 10% less mileage, but we could have probably fixed that. It's just we did not work. We were not working on that at the time. We were trying to get it so that it operated like a regular car.
Yeah, and even if it did suffer a loss of fuel efficiency, using 67% water would negate the.
Back then it was 75 cents a gallon retail for that product as opposed to a buck and a half. Imagine now it would probably be about 75 to 80 cents, or maybe a dollar as opposed to three, you know.
Yeah.
And I was working at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce when I ran into this, doing quite well, and I bailed out of there just to do this because I thought it was so important, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was important. It just that I wound up with a big problem when Herb had a stroke.
You know, that is a problem. What could have been done to have avoided a break in this technology advancing because of the death of the inventor?
Well, see, he was a wealth. What I didn't know, I worked with him for 8 years, and I visited him a lot in Elgin, Illinois, where most of the work was done there. Some was done here, but most of it was done there. And so I drive up there frequently, okay? And he lived in a house that had a yard that wasn't cut very often, and things were in a sad state of disarray, and there was kind of a mess in the kitchen and the house and the refrigerator. He didn't keep things. He was living by himself. He was divorced.
Okay.
So I had no idea that he was a wealthy guy. He had been a boiler engineer in Chicago, and he bought older buildings and rented them out, fixed them up and such, and he owned millions of dollars worth of Chicago real estate. So at any rate, he dies of a stroke, and the patent went into probate, and the family I checked every 6 months or so with the lawyer, and they were still fighting over all this property, and the patent was caught in that. And then I, in 1996, I ran into, I found out about Stan Meyer. I went and visited him, and he was, you know, potentially running on water. He had a process for running on water.
So you actually went to Grove City, Ohio?
I did indeed.
Met Stan Meyer at his home workshop?
No, actually, he had a little dog and pony show at a public building in a park.
Oh, so you...
There were a number of people there besides me. I was talked into going to this. A very good friend of mine asked me to go because he had another friend and his brother who were installed electrical equipment. That was their business, like electricians. And they wanted to go see this thing. They were all excited about it. And John told me about it, and they told me about it. And I said, you know, what a bunch of crappy run on water. Not even thinking that's what we were doing, you know, Herb and I. And but my friend prevailed on me and got me to go because he's a longtime friend of mine, and we worked together on a number of things. So at any rate, I went to this thing and was very skeptical. And these other two guys say Stan wouldn't do the testing they wanted, and they wanted to stick their nose in his business, and he didn't like that much. And I didn't. I don't operate like that, and I ingratiated myself with them. Got those two guys to go away, go have dinner or something, you know, while we talked. Yeah, but I couldn't get them to cease and desist doing cars and get to generators because you run a car on water, your life expectancy is very short, as he found out. Now, Herb, what I didn't tell you about Herb's demise is that Herb was Herb died of a stroke, okay? And that didn't bother me much. I mean, because he'd had a stroke and a heart attack before I met him. 2 months later, the Secret Service came to my home with a warrant to search my home and my office, and that didn't even bother me too much.
Say Secret Service, how did they present themselves to you? Did they just
Secret
show
Service.
Up? Did they call you ahead of time?
No, I wasn't here. I came home, and they were already here.
They were in your house?
Yeah. My parents, my wife and my son were here, and they, what presentation was made to them. So I don't know what happened. Oh, when I got here, they were here in my office.
They were already...
And I said, what the hell are you people doing here? Who are you? And he says, I'm Secret Service, and he identified himself and showed me the warrant, which is a warrant for search of the premises. And so I asked him what the probable cause was, and he would not answer me in any way. He'd not say anything. He just was mute, okay? And I asked him 3 times, and he did the same thing. He was mute. And so I said, well, the warrant says search of the premises, and since I'm not part of the premises, I'm free to leave, right? He said, yes, sir. And so I left and walked around the lake till they left.
Huh.
Because I didn't want to get any confrontation.
How were they dressed, and what did they arrive in?
Oh, nifty suits and stuff.
I mean,
they look like FBI agents out to go to a company or something, you know.
Yeah. In other words, there's this rumor that people are visited by men wearing black suits.
No, that's not. Well, this wasn't clandestine. This was done with a warrant and everything. When it's clandestine, they do that. But
yeah.
That's intended to harass and intimidate. And I think they knew by then they couldn't harass or intimidate me very well.
But you said Secret Service. Did you mean that, or did you mean
the Secret Service? Secret Service. You can go get a copy of the warrant, and that's what it says. That's it. And what it? But now, let me tell you, when I did get upset is when I went the next day to the federal courthouse and asked to see the warrant. And the clerk said, okay, and she came back and said, I'm sorry, I can't provide that to you.
Really?
I said, why? And I said, why? She says, well, because the judge has sealed the file for national security interests. And then the little bell rang in my head, and I started to think that maybe something was amiss here. And I believe that they whacked him. And see how what you can do, I know this for a fact. I know how to use frequencies to heal people. So if you can use frequencies to heal people, you can use frequencies to kill people, and that's undoubtedly what they did to her.
Now, when you're talking about using frequencies to heal people, are you referring back to the Raymond Rife type?
Yeah, that's an early version of it, but there's much more advanced work, including, I think, probably some of this came from Tesla originally, you know. Tesla was involved in some of that.
So you're surmising that your friend was murdered because of a search being done by the federal government after his death?
No. That's what got me to think that maybe he had been whacked because of the national security interest. What in the world was I doing that was national security interest relating to this? Nothing. What they want,
but
they use that as an excuse.
What they were interested in was your ethanol water carburation?
I have no idea. I wouldn't have. You know, I've run some political campaigns, but those were long gone. So I don't know what they were interested in because they didn't tell me. I know what they took. They took computer related stuff. I had a telecomputer to use to get leads for promoting things and selling things, and they took some of that. But I'm sure that they copied all my files about our project.
And so you feel that it was your energy research that led to their search of your premises.
Right.
Yeah.
Because that's the only place that they were. They were just down in my office.
Did you hear that such had happened at your friend's home also, or did you ever get any feedback from the family on what happened to his stuff?
No, I do not know. I can't tell you, but he was living alone, so it would have been very easy for them to do that. But all they have to do is take pictures. They don't have to steal anything.
Yeah, that's interesting that there was a...
But the vehicles were still there. They didn't take... It wasn't that big a deal. I mean, what we were doing was not rocket science, okay? They just wanted to discourage us from doing further. And they did discourage me. When I figured this out, I got to be much more careful in doing all this because I don't wish to be a statistic. I want to make them be the statistics, not me.
Yeah.
And we're headed towards that now. I mean, I've been persistent for a long time, and we're headed... There's a lot of things going on that are not going to be beneficial for the oil companies, and the oil companies believe in this stupid proposition of we're not going to have any more oil, and that's bogus because oil is a renewable resource.
Yeah, so you think that's a propaganda tool for raising the price?
No. I think they actually believe it. They're stupid enough to believe it.
But if they're the ones pumping it out of the ground, wouldn't they know that it's replenishing itself?
No, the Russians know. We don't know. It's called if you look it up, it's called adiabatic oil. And the truth is, oil is a mineral. Crude oil is mineral oils with carbon, and with carbonate. Okay, and the mineral oils come from where the magma or the molten core meets the crust. And these mineral oils are released there. They're very hot. They're thousands of degrees hot, and they start to migrate towards the surface. And when they get down to the 800 degree range or so, there are bacteria that can live at that temperature, and these bacteria thrive there. And their little bodies are the carbon in crude oil. And it has nothing to do with fossils. It's not fossil fuel.
Dinosaurs, huh?
The Russians have 310 oil wells that go down 10 to 12 miles deep. That's well below any existence of fossils in the history of the Earth. So it doesn't come from fossils. They call fossil fuel is a joke. Now, coal is a fossil fuel because you find the fossils in the coal. But there's never any fossils associated with the sandstone that oil comes out of, at least not to my knowledge.
So these are carbon fuels, not fossil fuels.
Yeah, well, what the Russians call them is adiabatic fuels. And that's probably a good description. Basically what it means is, the proof of that is there are two oil fields that I know of, one in Pennsylvania, which is one of the first oil fields in the history of the United States in Pennsylvania. It is now producing as much or more as it did years ago when they shut it down, and then they shut it down years ago because they were getting very little production out of it. And down in the Gulf of Mexico, there's a big oil field there, which is now productive again, which was shut down because it had become unproductive.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about ME squared is that what ME squared does is it actually breaks down the large, long carbon chains into shorter carbon chains, and it was developed to bring oil wells back into production. And it was developed by China Oil, which is the seventh largest oil company in the world. They buy old stripper wells or non-producing wells. The stripper wells, 1 to 2 barrels a day. They pour the stuff down the well, and pretty soon it's producing like it did years ago.
Wow. Very
because the pressure's still there. What's happened is the sandstone that oil is stored in gets clogged up with these heavy ends that eventually accumulate in there. And if you can break those heavy ends down, you release the resistance, and you get normal flow again.
But really, rather than rejoicing over this discovery, your work is all about teaching people that it is not necessary to be pumping oil out of the ground at all.
Well, no, that's not my work. My work is to help people improve their use of fuel, improve the situation so we can beat the devil out of the oil companies. That's my objective, is political. And I do have some technical qualifications, and I've done some testing, but I'm not. There are probably people that you're familiar with who know a lot more about the technical nature of a lot of these things, because my dad was a mechanical genius, but I am not. I'm a promoter and a person who is very interested in ideas, and I help and encourage inventors to get their idea to come to fruition.
Well, you're doing an excellent work in that you are teaching people that whatever fuel you use, you can use less of it and get the job done, and that produces less pollution.
Absolutely. Well, like here in Minnesota, I mean, our farm economy has just gone nuts because the price of corn has never, ever gone up at harvest time. Last year at harvest time, it went from $170 to $350.
Wow.
And it's at $375 now, and farmers are making a killing. In fact, all the land that they can get a hold of, they turn into corn production, but we're having a drought here.
American agriculture has been going down the tubes, and now
it still is.
Looking for extra land.
Yeah, it still is because the big farmers are eating up the small farmers, and we're getting to be agribusiness instead of farms. You know,
it's
a sad, sad thing.
Yeah.
And I tried to fight that battle back in the mid-80s, and that's very difficult. So the best thing I ever did was help promote ethanol, because that's helped the farmers a lot, at least the farmers in Minnesota. Illinois, Indiana, Iowa for sure.
Yeah, well, that's what's referred to as the Corn Belt, isn't it?
Right, right.
For those unfamiliar with that region of the U.S.
Right, right.
Well, we grow a lot of corn here in Kentucky also.
Absolutely.
Now,
but you got Kentucky is where a lot of good tobacco comes from too, though, right?
Well, it used to. Anymore, it's
not anymore.
Just about lost its share of the tobacco market, and it's being grown overseas now.
You should get those tobacco farmers growing ginseng I had know a couple farmers that made $250,000 on 2 acres of ginseng. It takes 3 or 4 years to get a crop, but they used a special product and process that I know of. And there's a lot of wonderful things going on in these areas that I'm interested in.
Well, we have a political candidate like yourself. He's run for governor several times and attorney general, and he's a hemp advocate.
Right.
And his contention is that at one time, hemp was the number one cash crop in Kentucky.
Yep, and pretty much the United States.
Really?
Well, have you ever seen any of the cloth or the clothing made out of hemp?
Well, I understand it's very fine.
It's soft, but it wears like iron. And they used to make all the rope for the ships out of hemp and all kinds of things. It's a terrific product, but they banned it. You know, the reason that the marijuana was banned was because hemp was very competitive. Nylon had come into existence, and they wanted nylon to be successful, so they got rid of hemp by banning marijuana.
Really?
And hemp is related to marijuana.
So in other words, you're saying that the petrochemical industry that produced nylon was responsible not only for the suppression of ethanol,
yep,
but also the suppression of hemp.
Sure.
As a competing product.
Certainly, they use politics, and what we need to do is learn how to use politics to reverse the situation, all right? And there are people doing that, except, unfortunately, a lot of them have a lot of the green movement that's going on. If you go back and look where their original money came from, it came from interesting people like the Rockefeller brothers and others. Because what they'd like to do is control both sides of the argument so they can get their desired result. I mean, they're mean, nasty folks. They're real smart. I've been fighting them for a long time. I when I ran for governor, there was a candidate, a LaRouche candidate in the Democratic Party who was doing the Rockefeller pitch, you know. And I had a lot of fun destroying him.
Very interesting.
And the governor was sitting there smiling like a Cheshire cat when I took on these other guys. Because the governor was a friend of mine, and the mayor of St. Paul and the wife of the mayor of Minneapolis were running together against him. And so I fixed their little red wagon with ethanol. Actually, the mayor of St. Paul did a little research, and he found out that the advantages of ethanol from Minnesota. He started agreeing with me, so I couldn't attack him.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah. So, but that's what I do is I choose a target and I eliminate him. I mean, I can tell you my two targets are this time, and you can count them out. One is Hillary Rodham Clinton, and the other is my senator Norman Coleman.
Okay.
One.
Well,
I choose to
abstain from politics, so I'm not.
Right, right. Well, but what I do, I'm going to use now the reason I'm telling you that is because it's of importance in what we're talking about here. I'm going to take a Firestorm spark plug and put it in a portable generator and turn water into electricity. You tell me that won't be well received in
okay,
the small towns.
Okay, let's talk about that now. Let's get on that subject because we have about 6 minutes remaining.
Okay.
You said you wanted to talk about the Firestorm, so let's talk about it.
Okay.
What's your knowledge about Firestorm? You understand? I understand that you know the inventor of the spark plug.
Yes, I went to see him twice in Detroit. He now lives in California, and his name is Robert Krupa. And
what's his experience with regard to spark plug technology? How did he get involved in it?
Well, his technical. He's an automotive engineer, and his specialty was electronics. Okay, and he worked for GM for 20 years. And then he was a consultant for Ford and Daimler, Chrysler, and Bosch spark plug. Now, he was an original. He did not design the split fire spark plug, but he helped the people that designed it promote it and build it into a business, and then they took advantage of me, and they made him mad, all right?
Now, this is a spark plug that had two
right.
Electrodes. Is that it?
No. Well, the electrode was split. Instead of the one bar over the top, it was split into two. So that some of the spark came right between those two legs directly, and so you got a quicker and a better spark.
Yes.
And they made him mad, so he tried to figure out some way to beat him, and he did.
And how is that? What is his design now?
Well, his design, he makes a little. Just envision a spark plug. You got the little hook that is the electrode, and then you've got the center electrode and then the hook, and the spark passes between the two. Well, if you took that hook and took that out of there and made, what he did is took two paper clips and made a little dome of two paper clips so that you had like four little legs joined with a little weld spot at the top. And he put in the beginning, welded a steel ball on that electrode so he had a perfectly round surface, a perfectly spherical surface, and then a sphere up above it of this, like this little dome. And what happened when he did this is that spark plug generates plasma. And plasma is an electron firestorm, like Tesla using, you know, the old movies where they would show the sparks dancing around, you know, like lightning bolts and all that. That's all done with plasma. And when a lightning bolt strikes the ground, if plasma is formed first, okay? So anyway, what he does is create this plasma firestorm in the cylinder, and anything that's in there, any gas that's in there, is turned into its basic constituents, like hydrocarbon fuel is turned into hydrogen and carbon and sulfur and oxygen and whatever is in there. And same thing with water. It converts water into hydrogen and oxygen instantaneously and then oxidizes the hydrogen.
So in other words, you can't have a water car without using electrolysis to break the water down. By simply
No, there's electrolysis that happens instantaneously,
yeah.
Because of this plasma. And not only that, the way it'll be, one of the major international automobile companies, which will be nameless, has offered the inventor $1 billion for a 2-year exclusive. He has a purchase order from them, and they want 21 million spark plugs in the first 2 years. Well, they got to start producing, and that of course that requires a lot of money to get started up because they have to do their testing first. And I was doing that for them, but I was reluctant to. I didn't want to be too successful doing that because I don't wish to be in manufacturing and production engineering. I did that years ago, and that's you don't get paid well, and it's just a pain in the neck. I'd rather do what I do. And he's found a firm outside the United States which has adequate funding and which has the technical capability to do what they got to do. So
very interesting.
And he's offered me marketing rights to the plug for direct sales and MLM. So it could be a very big thing if this all happens. And I've got the new design, and if I can get his permission, I'll make a couple spark plugs and have a couple little portable generators to go around the country to small towns and farming communities and show people what the future is.
So,
and I say it isn't going to happen unless it's done politically. So we all got to get together.
Yeah, I think that the more people that know about any alternative energy technology, the better.
Right.
Because the effort all along has been to suppress the knowledge of it, to keep people from knowing that it even exists. And the media has been used to do that. Instead of announcing when someone like Stan Meyer or Mr. Krupa is involved in producing something that works, they tend to ignore the inventor.
Well, they do a lot of interesting things. Typically, the way they basically suppressed all these, there's 900, you can go on the internet, there's at least 900, a website with 920 patents on there that you can go look them up in the patent office, right on the internet, and each one of them is assigned to different companies. And as soon as they got a hold of it, they just deep-sixed it. So they bought them to suppress them. And I know four people who have died who had ideas that they wouldn't give up, and three of them anyway got a guy showed up with a black bag with $250,000 in cash in it and offered that as a down payment for their patent and that they'd make a multi-million-dollar deal. And I guess the numbers are going up now. Now there's people can get as much as, 10, 20, 40 million.
Very interesting. But Mr. Krupa is not selling out.
Nope.
Unless, of course, the people who offered him this money do not intend to market it. They tend to stall and delay and pretend that they're...
Right. Well, see, the problem they have with that is I'm kind of well-known for this activity I'm involved in. And if they do something to cause him difficulty, they won't be getting to me. Because I got lots of people that I can work with. But that hasn't been necessary up to now. It's just that the people he's been involved with have all... Each one of the spark plug companies showed interest in it, tested it, and were all excited, and then when they figured out they couldn't break the patent, they dropped it. Except for Bosch, and Bosch went all the way through developing a plan and everything, but when they presented the plan and the program, to including test results, to their upper management, the upper management turned it down, said no, and wouldn't tell them why.
Yeah. Now, was this using the spark plug with water as a fuel, or are you just using
as
fuel?
Sure. You can. Well, you can use... He's tested diesel fuel in a diesel engine, and gasoline at various air-fuel ratios. Air fuel ratio using a gasoline engine, what's called the stoichiometric ratio, is 14.7:1, which is supposed to be the ideal ratio, but that's not true with the Firestorm.
What can you do with the Firestorm?
Robert did some testing. I provided him with a test device so he didn't have to be running tankfuls of fuel. And anyway, he at 24:1 air fuel ratio, he got a 40% increase in mileage. He got a 30% increase in horsepower. What he was running was a 300 horsepower engine in a Ford Thunderbird, about 1996, if I remember right. And so it went from 300 to 400 horsepower. It got 40% increase in mileage and elimination of most of the pollution.
And you're saying that he was using a much leaner mixture, fuel mixture, and yet achieving greater horsepower.
Normally, if you do that, if you talk to a racing guy, I've had a couple of racing guys tell me, you can't do it. You go to those higher fuel ratios, you're going to burn a hole right in the piston. I said, that's true, but that's not true here. And there's some reasons for it. You're so completely burning fuel that you're not getting the heat buildup like you get when you increase the air fuel ratio normally. Now, but he also tested at 30:1 and got a 70% increase in mileage and got a 40% increase in horsepower and virtual elimination of all pollution. You could probably breathe the effluent.
And so this is no other modifications to the engine whatsoever other than...
Yeah, you got to change the air fuel ratio, and in a current vehicle with injection, fuel injection and a computer, you've got to retrofit. You've got to reprogram the computer chip.
Yeah.
Or replace.
You're of the opinion, I understand from reading some of your bios, that the newer vehicles, I guess from 1996 forward in particular, have definitely been deliberately configured to not allow for improved fuel efficiency.
Correct. I have a 1994 Geo Metro. The EPA rating was 44 miles a gallon. The only thing that gets already 40 miles a gallon in the United States now are two Honda and Toyota Prius,
hybrids.
The hybrids. A year ago, we had five over 40. Now we got two. Now that's real progress. In Europe, there are 113 models of car that get over 40 miles a gallon. This is sick. This is sick. This country, we have intentionally shot ourselves in the foot. And what are we doing in Iraq? Everybody's all upset about the war. I tell people, don't be upset about it. You're upset about the wrong thing. Be upset about the cause of the war, which is our insatiable demand for oil, and the fact that these oil companies are aiding and abetting our insanity.
Yeah. Well, it's obvious that the whole world is under the influence.
Yep, but us more so than anyone, because we use more of it per person than anywhere else in the world.
I think I saw that in your literature. How many gallons a year are consumed of petroleum or of gasoline? Is it 4 billion?
No, that's Minnesota. That's Minnesota's 4 billion gallons of gasoline.
You're kidding.
No, we're going to be able to make, if we convert all of our corn into ethanol, we'll be able to make 1.2 billion gallons of ethanol. But if we use the corn stalks, then we can make all the fuel we need from corn.
And you're talking about just the state of Minnesota using that?
Just the state, that's right. We're about 1/50th of, when you figure things out, so it's about 50 times that, so it'd be 440, it'd be 200 billion gallons of gasoline.
Well, I know there was a Stephen Meyer interview on the Minnesota News Channel that's viewable online, and they showed an empty Olympic swimming pool with a reporter standing in the middle of it, and he said, this is how much fuel we use every minute or something.
Yep, yes, absolutely. And the sad part about all this is the fumes from that fuel, either as it evaporates before it gets burned or after it gets burned, those effluents cause cancer and have killed thousands, if not 100,000s, and maybe millions of people.
Yeah, apparently.
That's the insanity.
Care.
Pardon me?
Apparently someone doesn't care about those.
No. It could be. There's a lot of people believe that they're doing this intentionally.
Well, it would seem if there are alternatives that are readily available and that have been available for decades, the fact that we would continue to use products that are harmful, expensive, and lead to things like wars, you'd think that we would have.
Well, you know what? Here's what the problem is. Here in the state of Minnesota, let's take for instance, we got 40 cents a gallon tax on gasoline. Now, that's a serious amount of money for the state of Minnesota for roads and whatever else. And they don't wish to give up, though, that money. And so there is a reluctance to pursue any of these alternative energy ideas other than just as a, you know, to show they're doing something, all right? We forced their hand on ethanol because in Minnesota it's so important to the farm economy to have ethanol that it's now got a life of its own. And the oil companies say, well, it's terrible because you use more energy, you know, use more energy making it than you're getting. And that's actually a very bogus argument because their figures aren't 20 years old or something, and they're not correct. And the truth of the matter is Minnesota is more energy independent. We keep our prices low because we've got ethanol and we got lots of E85. Just imagine, you can go down and if you can find E85, go put E85 in your car. I did this with my car, and my friend John Bergen did it with his new Buick. And he says he filled it up completely with E85. He says it drove just fine. I didn't notice any change whatsoever.
And he wasn't driving a flux fuel type vehicle.
No, he was not, nor was I. But the thing is, when it gets colder, you will notice a problem.
Yeah.
And that's basically as temperature, you know, and here it gets pretty cold sometimes. So.
Well, that's not our problem today in July.
Yeah, you bet that. You got that right. You know that fuel efficiency changes as the temperature goes up.
Yeah.
That's why fuel-saving devices are real hot. I mean, you can sell them like crazy until about September when temperatures generally start to go down. Then when somebody buys some new product or your new product and puts it in his tank, and he does his, you know, he's got his baseline, and he's doing his testing, and he doesn't get the results like all the testimonials talk about, or even the EPA lab talks about, because the temperature's going down. So I have a little device called the scan gauge that people would be, if you go on the internet at www.scangauge.com, you'll find a device that you can plug into your computer that does a number of things. One of the things it does, it'll tell you what the code is that's turning your check engine light on, and you can look it up on the computer and see if it's serious or whether you should just ignore it. And you can also use the device to turn it off. And it gives you instant mileage results that are very accurate, because I've done some, and when I first ran into this, I did some testing, and it's much more accurate than the testing I was using before. It used to take me 3 hours, now it takes me 20 minutes.
Yeah, it seems like a useful device to have for people who are experimenting with alternative energy.
It's a useful device to have if you're going on a trip, because it can help you save fuel.
Right.
You know what you're doing, and you have an idea. You know, you need feedback to understand about mileage. And most cars still don't have computer. You don't have computer printouts. The computer's in there, and this actually does a better job of reading out the information than the fancier cars that got computer printouts, you know, or computer.
Well, and even without a scan gauge, during World War II, they suggested putting an apple on the dashboard. You know, if you can keep it there, chances are you're saving fuel.
True fact. I can tell you this: if you put E85 in there, you maybe not save fuel, but you sure do save money.
Yeah. Well,
now another thing is EPA is corrupt. I have two of the window stickers from the most popular SUV is a Ford Explorer, and two FlexiFuel Ford Explorers. They were rated at 20 miles per gallon on the road with unleaded, regular, and 15 miles per gallon with E85. And I found out it was 21 and 20, a 5% difference. And the EPA was lying through their teeth, so I repeated that with two more of them. I got similar results.
Interesting.
Instead of a 25%. Well, you tell me, if you just bought yourself a flexi-fuel vehicle and you could use E85 and get 15 miles a gallon, or use unleaded and get 20 miles a gallon, which one are you going to do?
Right.
But if it's 19 and 20, that's a different story. And then one of them's cheaper than the other.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, you think about it, it's like the FDA. Political appointees in the FDA and probably a lot of the people that work there came originally from drug companies. And they're going to go back to drug companies and get million-dollar pensions, the high mucky-mucks, the presidents and vice presidents and stuff. And the same thing is undoubtedly true of the EPA. People from oil companies and car companies are the people that have got experience that they hire for the EPA.
Well, as they say, follow the money.
Yeah, you bet.
And it's always there.
And politicians, most of the politicians in Washington have been bought and sold 14 times. Just if you take, I don't know if there's a movie called Sicko right now that kind of points this out. With the drug companies and the HMOs, the healthcare companies, they've got three lobbyists for every congressman in Washington, D.C., just that industry.
Amazing.
And if I'm talking oil companies or any of the rest of it. But the drug companies are the biggest dog in the hunt.
It's a sad testimony to what human governments have accomplished really throughout history.
No, it's a sad testimony. It's our fault. Yours and mine and everybody else, because we could have done something about that, and we haven't been paying attention.
Yeah.
And when somebody says that we believe newspapers and magazines that are lying to us.
Yeah, but apparently these problems go back to ancient history. And
indeed, that's true.
You know, it's not unique to the United States, and it's not unique to our generation.
And it's not unique that a country will develop a bureaucracy and completely bury itself in paper or clay tablets like the Babylonians. <you know?
laughs> Well, Mr. Rattay, it's been a great pleasure to talk to you. You have a lot of accumulated knowledge on this subject. Well, a first-hand experience that is a great benefit to the listening audience for people to know that individuals like yourself with your knowledge and your background are able to do good in educating others as to what's possible and what we should be doing.
Ken, I would like to give you a little aside. I ran for the U.S. Senate here in Minnesota last year and talked about energy independence, specifically to help a Senate candidate because she was reading her speeches and not generally doing very well, even though she was an attorney. Well, I got her to quit reading her speeches and start talking about energy independence. And when I watched in the final election last November, I was watching, instead of going around the parties that go on at that time, I watched C-SPAN, both C-SPANs and some of the news channels, whenever they had some congressman on there accepting, you know, his election, you know, or U.S. senator. And a number of them were talking about energy independence, okay? And one of them actually used my slogan of energy independence in 10 years or less. And that kind of woke me up. I said, you know, I think maybe we had a little effect this time.
Yeah, now what's another slogan that was attributed to you? I thought I saw on the internet.
Now it's 6 years or less. Because I said 10 years or less if we get a Democratic Congress, and now we got a Democratic Congress, so it better be 6 years or less, and they better be doing something about it or they're going to be gone.
Yeah, well, this is another statement or comment about the difference between an inventor and an observer or something or a critic. It said that one inventor is worth so many people, you know.
See, what the inventor always needs, like Thomas Edison, the reason he was successful, he had a promoter and a sales guy, because inventors are not good at that. Engineers are not good at that. And I'm an engineer, but I've always known how important it was to be able to sell your ideas as well as be able to think of them.
Yeah, and it isn't always compatible, is it? The marketing
they can't be, because a person who is an inventor is a person who is thing-orientated, thinks about things. A person who is a promoter, a hustler, or a PR guy, or kind of like I am, I'm interested more in people and their response to ideas and how to get them to warm up to an idea. Because a new idea, only 3% of the people will pay any attention to a new idea the first time they see it. Take 7 repetitions before you get a substantial percentage to pay attention.
Yeah, interesting. Well, this show is one of those repetitions. I hope it serves its purpose. I'd like to talk to you again, and especially along the lines of the firestorm and the use of the firestorm spark plug with water as fuel.
I'm anticipating that I will have a little generator in 2 months.
Wow.
Or less. And if I do that, I'll certainly be in touch with you. I'm going to go to New Hampshire, South Carolina, Iowa, and then also Minnesota.
Well,
the small
we'll be town. Passing through Kentucky, because I'd love to.
Well, it's kind of on the way, probably coming back from South Carolina.
Yeah, sounds good.
Because first place I'll go is here in Minnesota to do a little test run. Where I'll get real serious will be Iowa and then New Hampshire and then South Carolina.
And this is nothing more than a standard, like, single-cylinder generator using a firestorm spark plug and water as fuel. Is that correct?
Yep, and they don't need a computer chip there because all you got to do is adjust the carburetor. See, with carburetor engine, all you need is the spark plugs, because you can change the air fuel ratio in the carburetor. And when we finally get these, there'll be a lot of interest in cars with carburetors.
Oh yeah, well, I'm buying them up even as we speak.
Yeah, well, good plan. Because they're classics. They're getting to be classic. All of them are just about an hour plus.
Yeah, well, I picked up a 1959 Pontiac, a Catalina, for $300.
Oh.
And, you know, it looks terrible, but the engine runs, the car drives.
Yeah, and tell me, yeah, well, just think about this. So dying these little cars and getting a 70% increase in mileage, and you get, I'll get some carbureted cars that are reasonably efficient and get them so they get a 70% increase in mileage. You won't have a hard time selling them for a serious profit increase. That's
yeah.
what I used to tell people when with our conversion for running on low-proof ethanol, that what we ought to do is not try to sell the unit. What we ought to do is convert vehicles and sell the vehicle that's running on water and ethanol.
There's some value-added products right there.
You bet.
Yeah. Well, listen, so nice talking to you, and I appreciate your willingness to do this at late notice.
No
Hopefully
problem.
We can get back together and talk more about the...
This is what I do all day long.
All righty. Well, thanks
okay.
so much for joining us.
You bet.
Uh-huh. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.